Way better, alcoholic.
Love shop's open. Let's all help Joe count as we understand him. See, that hair is weighing him down. Now, he made fun of my head, didn't he? So it's free territory, isn't it?
Driver's license. And what it was like.
Affiliation with God and the church. And at some point, I got to cover a story. And I found him. And being there, this piece of paper for days on end, God as I understand God is. And I just, you know, the grandiose thoughts of everything in common with you, or some woman who has nothing in common with you, and admit that that person might be able to teach me something about me as a start. You know? It talks about, I wanted to read something. I saw about 2.5 years at this point.
I had the election, I have got elected to the city of San Bernardino City Council. This is in the city. I got elected. I got more votes than anybody else in the campaign. I couldn't believe it. I'd never been to Sacramento. I didn't know where it was. Every week or every few days. One of the things about being in the legislature that many years ago, it was that. But you know what? I got out of the hospital and kept going back to that meeting. I'd go every week. I didn't go 90 meetings in 90 days. One of the people that I met was the lady who invited me to come and speak here to you tonight in a register step. And then Rita, who came in there to that unit, calling despair. I heard somebody talk one time about being on your hands and knees and going backwards. I went back home to Carmichael, and the funniest thing happened. I had this love kind of begun to wash away. You know, no matter whatever happens to me, if nothing else ever happens to me, the fact that my feeling was enormously touch once my mind is dreamed for me was to have the right stories. The guy could have written me a ticket, I wouldn't have been mad. You know? I mean, here's this guy out doing his work, it's raining, he probably wishes he was anywhere else, and he takes his second convention center for one purpose, and it was almost like nobody knew or nobody cared. Now I know, of course, that lots of people know. We do, whether it's eating, screwing.
We got married, and we have 6 children. 7 years. Me. So I didn't want to come to AA. He said, well, put his arms around you, even people in AA. Maybe because of human nature. Years later, going to step meetings, one day I was listening to someone reading the 11th step of the prayer of St. Francis, and he was saying, Lord, I pray that I may understand rather than to be understood. Every time I hear that, I remember the lawyer. I guess that's what the kind of a person who will put our arms to a bum is, a person who has that understanding. Of course, I didn't know anything about it. I was leaving because I didn't belong there. And as I was leaving, he stopped me and he says, you know, before you leave, why don't you meet some of my friends? And I think what touched me, and I think that listening to different speakers this weekend, it seems that God works the way it works. It seems that we're all different and that he touched us in the way that he does. People really took interest in me. I liked it. And that's what allowed me to come back. And I needed to come back. I needed to learn what I have learned in those years in the program. Because like someone was saying, I never knew that I was a sick person. And people that I have met, those 7 years that I drank, nobody ever said, John, you know, you're sick. They said other things, like the judge one time. I was facing the judge one time. He said, John, now he calls me John. That's the man I met 43 times. He wasn't a friend, but he calls me John. He says, the Fayette Park in the city of Syracuse, where you picked up last night, that's for the decent people to go there on Sunday. It's not for people like you. And because the way I felt about myself, I believed that. And one of the things I'm grateful for is I don't feel the way about that, about myself tonight. I really enjoyed being here. I feel kind of proud that I can stand up here and share my life. Or maybe I feel grateful. I don't particularly like the idea of traveling on a jet. I've been having problems lately. I was on a jet not too long ago, and the captain said, I don't want to discourage anyone, but we lost one engine. I said, I'm discouraged. Shouldn't have told me that. The next trip I took, we got hit by the thunder or something. You know, and every time anything happens, you know, I start saying, God grant me the serenity, and the captain came over and looked at the wing and said, I guess we're all right. Well, I wasn't. Not at all. Then I was going to Alaska. Somebody invited me to go to Alaska. In Chicago, I spent 5 hours because they find out the generator, something happened to the generator that's supposed to keep this motor going. This weekend, I'm in Minneapolis 1 hour going around up there. And all I could think about was my kit would say down home, just carrying the message, sucks. But I'm glad I'm here. I want to thank you for that fruit basket you've given me and wonderful dinner that didn't cost me anything tonight. Tasted good. I got a king-size bed that I really don't need all of it. So if anybody looking for a bed that's free, we can sit down and talk about what it used to be like. What happened? And what it's like today. As you probably know by now, I'm a Canadian. I was brought up in a small little reservation in Canada. And like so many of us, my father liked to drink. When he died, our family got sick. We lost 8 members in my family in 5 years. All my family died with TB. My mother died with TB too when I was 13, and I share this because I had a lot of fears in life. I had, people, alcoholics sometimes talk about wanting to commit suicide. It never entered in my mind. I was always afraid in those days that I was going to die. I felt I was treated like if I had TB. And one of the things I've learned in my recovery that I have a tendency of suffering from what you people call an obsession. A fear to me, it does something to me. And I couldn't forget. I couldn't sleep. I was sleeping with my mother And I asked her one morning if I was going to die. And, you know, she was dying. But I thought I was, too. And she said that that I was very strong and that I was different. And when my mother died, I didn't look for a home because I felt I wasn't wanted, so I lived in an all-empty house for about a year. But you know, I've learned, you learn a lot in recovery. And inside is healthy. And God make us that way. I learned that I'm the type of person who seeks rejection. And that's a hard thing to overcome. And it goes back even in my own home with my own people. I can understand when people said I felt alone. I did too. But it wasn't because of my people. I choose to live in this old empty house with a dog. And I couldn't sleep. I had a lot of problems. I discovered when I was about 14 years old that if I started to pretend that I'm somebody else, I could find some comfort and I could fall asleep. So I have taught myself as the years went by to pretend that I am somewhere else, that I lived in a big house and that I had a lot of nice clothes and money and big car and a nice girl. Hell, if you're going to dream. It doesn't cost any more to pile it up. I learned to relax. I was 14 years old. You know, it's really worse kind of a sickness when you start denying yourself from who you are. In a time in my life when I didn't even did anything bad. I have done nothing to be ashamed of. Nothing to feel guilty about. I had all those things that I brought into a program. I think that's why when Bill Wilson wrote the steps, he knew somewhere there is this Indian. It's all screwed up. He needs to sit down one day and take his own inventory. He needs to find someone for once in his life and tell the truth about who he is. Maybe if I can do that, I would stop wishing that I should be somebody else. I bring this up because if you knew and if you don't know, escape is comfort, but escape is denying yourself from who you are. Denying yourself from who you are, you never grow. You can't get any place. But God didn't make you for you to deny yourself. God made you for you to have strength to make a decision and to have choice. And to be effective, to be proud of yourself, to trust yourself, to be able to love, to be able to be grateful. So many things that we can do. I know nothing about it. My people worked in lumber camps in Maine. So I left home when I was 14 and I arrived in Patton, Maine, and I wanted a job in the woods, but the fellow said I was too skinny, too young, and it was against the law to hire kids. He said the CC camp was 20-some miles in the woods and then needed a dishwasher because the Army, the Second World War, a lot of people were joining the Army and they needed help. So I walked and I arrived there and I met a man by the name of Bill Langster. He gave me a job and I was with him for 4 years. When I was 18 years old, some people suggested that I should join the younger people, that I needed to be with the younger people. Well, I I thought that I would join the army, then go back to my home and show my people that now I'm a soldier, that I have grown. What I didn't know was that if you cannot read and write in Canadian Army, you're not allowed to go on training. I joined the Canadian Infantry in Quebec City, of all the places, all French, and I don't talk French. And now, I don't mind washing dishes in lumber camp, but in the Army, it told me that I wasn't as good as the next person. That's one of my problems for so many years. What is it in our recovery, the second step? Of all places, second step talks about believing. He identifies faith as the spirit of independence. Bill Wilson said, a person without faith is one who seeks approval. You live on what other people think about you. You will go as far as to tell lies about yourself just to be accepted. Boy, could I identify with that. Faith, he said, is the spirit of independence. You know, when I was sober 5 years, I was still in skids, and I was sleeping in a men's room in a hotel in Marlboro. I just arrived there, 1 o'clock in the morning. I was 33 years old by this time. And if you came to me that night and said, John, what is your problem at the age of 33? 5 years sober? Well, I would tell you, you know, I'm an Indian. And you know, if you have a problem with Indian, you got one. Because you're going to be one the rest of your life. Second thing is, you know, I can't read and write. I'm just an unfortunate person. I never had a break. Bill Wilson said, one who rationalizes and justifies, the list is long. If I had a nice girl, and if I have a nice home, and a nice car, and my new set of teeth, because by that time I lost 4 of them. I met one that I couldn't communicate too well with. And if I had money, if I had all these things, I wouldn't feel the way I do. You know, the amazing thing is when you have that type of sickness, night after night you sit next to a person who has a home, who has a nice wife, who has money, who has a nice clothes, who has a nice car. What you don't know is that you both feel the same way. His rationalization is different. He probably says, that bitch I live with. Anyone living with that bitch would feel the way I do. But I never could see it. Can you imagine if someone came to me when I first came to AA and said, John, you stay sober, and one day you will receive a call from Omaha, Nebraska. They're going to pay your expenses. You'll have a king-size bed. They will take you out. But most of all, you can stand up there and you wouldn't be ashamed because you don't have an education or because you don't talk with English. Can you imagine if someone came to me that night and said, John, one day you live in a 14-room house? Not too long ago, I bought my wife a Chrysler. Fifth Avenue. Not Fourth, Fifth Avenue. Paid $18,000. My wife just find a job, you know, she's like me, she doesn't have a talent, so she's got a job, she gets paid $4.50 an hour. It tickles me to think that she arrives with $18,000 automobile. The army was very difficult for me. Because I'm truly an obsessed person. Washing dishes for me was an obsession. I told lies about it. Because you couldn't tell a girl, you know, you're washing dishes. Why couldn't you? If you believe the truth, it's more honorable than lie. If you believe that the truth doesn't disarm you from being a great person. But I think just backwards. Now, I wouldn't go home to my people because I didn't want them to know. See, I lost the brother in war. And I didn't want anybody to know that I was washing dishes. So I told lies about it. What I really wanted was a drink. But I wouldn't drink because you've heard it in AA. I didn't want to be like my father. So I didn't drink until I was 21 years old. I was with a fella. We come around together a long time. He was a farmer. This lady is a farmer. Only this guy wasn't a farmer. He wanted to be one. I mean, that's all he talked about. Every time we go out, we talk. One time, him and I decided, we were 18 years old, so we decided, someone said, that in St. Lawrence Street in Montreal, you can go over there if you have money and pick the girl that you like. And have fun. So we saved our money, and we got all dressed up, so we looked good. In case they wouldn't like us, you know. So we went over to St. Lawrence Street, where you can fix the girls, and we stood there. And we stood. And we stood longer than most girls did. That's the kind we were. We were trying to convince each other which one should go and ask. Finally, he did, and he came back. He was all upset, and he said, John, you wouldn't believe. I said, what? He said, she wants $25. I said, what's wrong? We got a lot of money. He said, John, you don't understand. He said, down home, you can buy a cow for $25. Now, that's a farmer, right? That's an obsession. We got our discharge, and he says to me, what do you say we buy suits and we'll have a few drinks and we'll meet some girls? And I thought it was a good idea. So he brought us, we went to Bloery Cafe in Montreal, and the third floor you walk in, and four-piece orchestra playing, and in front there was a girl singing, practically with no clothes on. And I think that's where I received my first spiritual experience. But then I took a drink. I like drinking. I really don't understand too much about drinking. Some people tell us we drink for the effect. I suppose we do. But I needed a drink. Or I like drinking because, well, for one thing, I can get close to people. And I'm not even today, I realize the value of being able to be open and share your life. But to me, it's a very slow process in life. I'm sure I'm much better than what I used to be. But I enjoy drinking because I can get very close to people. I enjoy not being afraid what people might think about me. I suppose it was the some kind of a freedom that I have never had. I like that. But the other part I like too is I like to be crazy. I enjoy being able to be crazy. I can't do that sober because I'm so sensitive of being intelligent. And I can't stand anyone who is stupid or ignorant. It bothers me. But that's not what really bothers me. What bothers me is I have trouble what St. Francis talks about, what the lawyer had. I have trouble saying, Lord, I pray that I may understand rather than to be understood, or that I accept rather than control. When you control, you destroy a relationship. When you accept, you put us together. But you control with intellect. But relationship is spiritual. It's not intellectual. It is not a question you're right or wrong. Question is, in this life there is something greater than what is right and what is wrong. And that is the ability to be able to accept. You know that lawyer, it is so important. That lawyer who put his arms around me when I myself didn't know I belonged here. It was enough to bring me back. Another thing I like about drinking, because I can accept that I'm crazy, I suppose. I like falling in love every night. You know, I look at this girl and she's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. You think? She is. But not necessarily so, because alcohol also affects your vision. You know, you wake up in the morning and you say, holy Christ. You were so cute last night. But you know, you take a drink and you love all over again. And I love that. I love to be that crazy. I love fights. Because I get bored. I can be in a bar room drinking, and I look around and I'm bored. And I'll spot someone that I don't like the way he looks. A few more drinks and I will approach him. I don't like you. Johnny says, I don't want any problems. I said, it's too damn bad you don't get it anyway. I love that. And then they would call a cop. And everybody thinks that's when I'm supposed to leave. But then that's when just the fun starts. This guy who just opens the door for me. His cop is going to find out who they're dealing with. And when they get to know you, they come three or four. That's even better. And it's fun. I remember one morning I was in the court, and this big fat policeman came over and he held his pants. The leg was missing. Everybody in the court laughed. Judge laughed, so I laughed too. It was fun. Until he gave me 6 months, then. It wasn't fun anymore. Everybody was laughing but me. But alcoholism, it gets worse. And the day comes when you don't fall in love every night anymore. No more fights. You don't get close to people anymore. It doesn't do anything. And you can't stop. I knew I couldn't stop. I also knew it was first drink. I have known that for years. But I never knew that I was powerless over one drink, and I didn't know I was an alcoholic. But I've always known that once I took a drink, I never stopped. When I was asked to come here, I know it was probably one of many important days in my life. But I came here because I was hungry. I needed a donut, free coffee. I came back. The second important person I met was my sponsor, Pat. Now, I knew Pat. I never liked Pat. He was a bum longer than I am. He had a degree. I used to say, there is nothing worse than a bum with a degree. Unbeknown to us then, periodically, Pat would disappear from the skid. Sometimes 6 months he would be gone. And he joined AA. When I met Pat, I was in Central Group one night. He walked in all dressed up. And he comes to me and he said, John, I'm your sponsor. He said, I have a new car outside. And he used to pick me up every night and used to bring me to a meeting. And sometimes he would bring me a sandwich. He used to say he can only eat half of it. And I don't know what's going on, you know. Because I think sometimes we're so into ourselves, it's like a one big obsession, that we really don't see what's going on. I never really cared that Pat picked me up every night. It was years later when someone once said, you ever stop and think that Pat never eats sandwiches? And someday, if you're lucky enough, you stand up here and you brag about $18,000 Chrysler. Nice hotel room. Feeling good about yourself. To be able to learn and identify with the speaker. To be able to tell a joke and laugh. But it's so important to realize where does it come from. It is so real to know that there have been people in my life who took time to help me when I didn't even know that I needed help. When there was no gratitude in my life, there is no question that there is such thing what St. Francis talks about. That you and I are very, very capable of understanding rather than wanting to be understood. That we are very capable of buying a sandwich, bring it to a person who doesn't even know that he needs help. That is a very healthy state of mind away from ourselves. Among other things, that I stopped at noontime meeting, Thanksgiving. It's the dropping center, and people come over there and they bring turkey. They had a meeting 10 o'clock, and there was this big guy sitting there, weighs 200 or so. He was sad. He said, I just been to my father and my mother. I went there today, he said. I had all the intentions to hug my father. We have not done that, he said, since I can remember. I wasn't sure I could hug my father, he said. But I was pretty sure that I could hug my mother. But I said, I just couldn't do it. And I was sitting there. And I can identify with that. I don't know what it's worth when you have father and mother that you cannot hug. Or when you don't have them. But we all have a past that we have to live with. Some lady said today, if you are a parent, when you go home, you make a point that you tell your daughters and sons that you love them. But I see an awful lot of sons and daughters sitting here. What about you? When you go home and tell your father and mother that you love them. What the hell you think? Is one-sided? I have six children. I call them an Indian hug. I give them an Indian hug. They bring somebody home. He says, Daddy, give her an Indian hug. Once I gave them a hug, they don't want it anymore. Because I squeeze them to death. Yes, love is important. But you don't have to be perfect to be able to love. What do? You need to be sober 6 months to be able to love? You have to get well first? You have to be right first? St. Francis said, you're born with gifts that God gave you. You have right to choose. And if you want love, you love. I remember when I first got married, you know, I was 35 years old. And, you know, I never had a relationship. I never lived with anyone. I wasn't in no condition. Where are you going to bring a girl when you live in skid? I didn't even have a chance to have trouble with somebody else's wife. You know, I was speaking with Al-Anon, and I don't say anything with Al-Anon, I loved him, but it was an Al-Anon anniversary, and this lady, Al-Anon speaker, she keeps saying, I never woke up with strange men. She said it two or three times, I thought she was complaining. I get up and I said, I've always woke up with strange women, and I liked it. It could have been somebody else that I wouldn't like it. You know, my sponsor, he had a habit of not being there on time. And that used to burn me. 15 minutes late, and I would be so mad I wouldn't go with him. I walk. I mean, it's not easy to help a person like that. I didn't know I was perfectionist. I was 40 years old when I discovered I was perfectionist. I mean, if you see me laying in the sidewalk with long hair, wine sores, and dirty, would you say, this guy is perfectionist? He's a perfectionist. When someone once told me I was perfectionist, I was glad it sounded so. I never thought how much problem it got me. Seventeen years later, you know, my sponsor took a drink, and he died. Called me up one time. It was in Buffalo, New York. John says, I'm in trouble. I drank. So I said to my wife, you know, the man helped me an awful lot. I'm going to see if I can find him. I found him. I was living in Marlboro, Mass. At the time. And, you know, by this time I had cars and I was doing all right. And he says to me, John, I almost died. That damn stuff almost killed me, he said. So I brought him to Syracuse because he wanted to go over there. He took a drink in Syracuse and he died in West Street. This is where him and I used to exchange blows. Months ago, when he said, John, the damn thing almost killed me. But he taught me something, Pat. You know, I guess what he taught me was that someday this Indian wouldn't be a bum anymore. And someday I live in a 14-room house and I'll have a car and price I even pay taxes. And it's not easy when you know that this country was ours before it was yours. Someday when I have all these things, there'll be maybe someone who comes to see me. But as you know, it's quite a thing to be able to be invited. It feels good when your opinion is honored from your fellow man, knowing that it's something you cannot buy. That it is not something that somebody gives you. It's not a gift. but it's something that you have decided to choose in your own life. People will honor your opinion if you honor your own. Beautiful thing. Someday, instead of being a bum looking for help, there's always another one. Comes along and said, John, you think you could help me? And all you can think about is that sponsor. Somebody who taught you the value of love. Someone who stopped the car and buy a sandwich for a bum who lives in a mission. Pick him up every night when he's not even grateful. When he's mad because you're late. One day when you learn to get well, you learn to put pieces together, and the value is that one day you share the same thing to another person. You know, to pass it on. And to some extent I do that. I never do anything well, but I go along. When I arrived in Marlboro, Mass., I was 5 years sober and I was in skid. I met another important person in my life. I'm going to share this, and I think it's late. He says, John, there's a new meeting starting in, they started in Worcester a week or so ago. Would you like to go? I said, sure. And that was a step meeting. Now, I knew there were steps. In Syracuse, New York, every meeting, they would read the steps and traditions and fifth chapter. And if you have any mind at all, you can memorize these things. And I knew what fifth chapter says. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. But they had no step meetings in Syracuse, New York. Back in 57, there were no step meetings. And there were none in Massachusetts. They started this one. Father Fred, who was a good friend of mine, who's still alive. Eddie D, who was sober. He was a newspaper reporter, sober about 40 years. There were a lot of people who knew something about what this was all about. And I walked in there, and what they did was the pages of the steps, like 6-7 pages. And that's the first time I'd heard about a recovery. And then you had these people who would express their ideas, their insights as to what step means to them. And of course, I was confused. I had never heard him before. I certainly didn't believe that night that I need this program to recovery. I really believe what I told you, that if I have a car and a girl and a home and a job and money, that I would be all right. Because after all, you know, second step talks about coming to believe that there is a power greater than ourselves. You know, of course, if you believe, maybe you wouldn't look for approval. If you believe something, maybe you will learn that what you want cannot get from the outside. That no matter how much person loves you, he cannot give you. God didn't make you that cheap. God gave you a choice. Right for you to be able to choose for your life. And if you don't choose, you know. But it seems to me, from the time I could remember, at the age of 13, sleeping between two mattresses, my greatest desire was to be somebody else. And I find comfort pretending that I'm somebody else. I could actually fall asleep. Faith. I have never found faith as something very comfortable. I do understand today, while maybe it is true that faith is not that comfortable, it is the magic that allows you to go from where you are with what you have in life. I was not capable of doing that when I was 13, when I was 20, when I was... But I needed, my better judgment was, I needed people in AA. I needed the moral support. I needed the understanding. I needed to learn how to pray. I needed to learn how to believe. I needed all those things. And with that, it has been 29 years for me, and I'm just slowly growing every day. sometimes I walk, when I don't feel good, I walk into my house, I looked around with my kids, and you know what I said? You're a bunch of assholes. You know why I know that? Because I am one myself. It's beautiful when you know that nobody is perfect. It's even beautiful to know that's the way God made us. We born and die imperfect. But who says you have to be perfect for that magic that lawyer had to be able to understand? Who said you have to be perfect to do what Saint Francis said? For it is in self-forgetting that you find. It is a person who tries to be perfect. He never goes any place. It is also a person who never finds too much happiness, because there is a certain amount of happiness comes from imperfection. Believe it or not. You know, if you make a mistake, if you hurt someone, say you're sorry. If you do that, you find freedom. More important, you develop a trust and respect. You never get that by trying to be perfect, but you get that by dealing with imperfection. I never understand what life was all about. Paul owned a restaurant. I used to go over there. Rita, she was a waitress. She said, "John, can you paint a house?" I said, "Sure." You know, when I was drinking, I used to paint steeples in the church because they couldn't get anyone sick enough to, you know, get that high. I was high anyway. Anyway, she said, "Would you come over and give me an estimate in my house?" And I did. I gave her an estimate of $300, and I got my first job. But I was sleeping in a men's room in a hotel, and I said to Paul, "Well, I got a job, but I don't have any money." Paul says, "I figured now that I'm president in my own company, I should buy white coveralls." Bought some paint, brought everything to a job. I went to meeting Saturday night, and the fellow by the name of Joe, who works in the telephone company, someone said, "Ask him, he's got a lot of ladders." I asked Joe if he could loan me a ladder. He said, "If you don't tell anyone, it's against the rules." He said, "Pick it up." I said, "I don't have a car." He said, "I'll deliver it." I finished painting the house, and I owed Paul $65 for the groceries. I met a plumber in AA. He said, "John, I'm told you paint houses." I said, "Sure. 7 miles from here, all you need is a stepladder." So I bought a stepladder, and I got all my glove cloths together, and then I stood in the corner, and I stopped the bus. And this guy, he looks at me, and he looks at my ladder. He said, "You're not serious." I said, "I am. I'm self-employed, and I have no other means of getting to work." He said to me, he was a little bit soft himself, I guess. He said, "If I give you a ride, would you promise you'll never do it again?" Next, I was a school teacher. She taught school 40 years, and she retired. There were 69 questions you have to pass, so I asked her if she would help me to memorize them. And a couple of months later, I knew the questions inside out, and I went over and took the test in Marlboro. They put you in a little room. And this guy, he only asked me 2 questions. And I was insulted. I didn't want to leave. I said to myself, "What in the hell's use to have all these educations? Nobody cares." Nobody cares. But here I am in my 5th year sobriety, president in my own company. I have a driving license. And Paul, who owned the restaurant, he came with 11 passenger station wagon, big black station wagon with seats in the back. Said, "They want $750, John. It's yours." So I had no money, but I was painting a house, and I asked the lady, I think it was $250 down payment. Paul said I could. And a girl who belonged to Saturday Night Group, she co-signed for me, and here I was in my 6 years sobriety, president in my own company. I had a driving license and 11 passenger station wagon. So I decided to find me a girlfriend. But I had 4 teeth missing. And I felt you couldn't find the type of a girl that I was looking for with 4 teeth missing. That's why I lost my teeth at Smitty's. Smitty's in Syracuse, that's where all the New York Indians drink. I'm a Mi'kmaq Indian. I don't drink in Smitty's because Mi'kmaq Indians and New York Indians don't communicate too well. Every once in a while, 20 of us Mi'kmaqs would get drunk and we'd go to Smitty's and we would communicate. One day I was walking by Smitty's and you told Smiley. Smiley was my friend. He had one long little Irishman with a degree. I picked him up and I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Those Indians." I said, "Well, they can't treat you like that." He said, "No, they can't." So I said to him, "What do you say you and I go in there and we'll clean them up? Did you ever feel like that when you're drunk?" Oh, God. We went in there and Smiley says to me, "John, it's a good idea." Well, by the Jesus, it wasn't a good idea. No. That's where I left my 4 teeth. And there is Smiley, not even a scratch. He's so damn skinny, they wouldn't hit him. And they almost killed me. So I had this 4 teeth missing. And someone said, "There is a new dentist in AA." So I looked him up, found him. And I kind of examined him for 2-3 weeks because I don't like pain. But I said to myself, he's the type of person who would never hurt no one. And that's one among many mistakes I made in my sobriety. But he gave me his card, and a few months later I have to see. Then I met Mary in AA, a woman by the name of Mary. She said, "John, I'm told you have a car." I said, 11 passengers. She said, "I run the home of an alcoholic woman. I have 9 girls. I'm looking for someone to bring these girls to a meeting. Would you like the job?" I said, "I'll be very happy to." That's where I met Kathy. On our way from meeting, I said to her, "Would you like to go out on date?" And she said, "No." You know, she didn't even think. Total rejection. And I was hurt because I don't like rejection and I don't like pain. I'm a sensitive person. I get hurt easily and I don't suffer well. On my way home, I said to myself, "Who in the hell she thinks she is? You see, she has nothing. And here I am, I'm president in my own company. I have no teeth. Riding around with 11 passengers." Thursday night comes along and picks the girls again, and on our way back, I said to her, "Would you like to go to a show in Boston?" She said, "Yes." And we did, and on our way back, I asked her to marry me. She said, "But I don't know you." I said, "It's all right. We still have 5 miles to go. We'll get acquainted." That was before, in those days, of course, these days, I don't know, people in my area, you know what they tell the new people? Don't have a relationship for a year. I don't know what they're going to tell you at the end of the year. It's all in 1 year now, maybe you can get laid or something. I just want you to know that that's not what Bill Wilson says. Bill Wilson says, "You and I have a terrible time with relationships. 3 reasons. Number one, We're self-willed in extreme. A self-willed person is a person who don't share, a person who controls. You don't have relationship controlling. 11th step St. Francis talks about. Understand and accept rather than control. Bill Wilson said an alcoholic is self-centered in extreme. His greatest desire is to be central attraction. He says he's grandiose. But he said, if you have taken first 5 steps in AA, Bill Wilson said, you have opened the door to a relationship. You haven't learned how to have one yet. But you have opened the door. If you don't understand sitting there, if you are new, then it's your damn fault. There are step meetings. It is your life. And I'm not saying this. I'm saying I was sitting there in my 5th year of sobriety. And I didn't understand one word what AA was all about. I remember, you know, Kathy and I were married for a little while. You know, 1st year, you don't discover any wrongs. All you could think about is bed. You don't see that person has wrongs. But Kathy doesn't have any more wrongs than I do. But about a year later, we had one child or something I discovered on Wednesday. Kathy would like to wash clothes. Like Italians like spaghetti. She likes, well, they do. One of my daughters married one of them. He likes spaghetti. She washed clothes and then put them in the little bundles and she got them all over the place. Now you must realize I'm a perfectionist. Well, I come home one day and I see these clothes all over the place. Well, I'm sober 5-6 years, so I'm not going to blow my top. I'm going to sit down and talk to her. I said, honey, these clothes drive me crazy. Next time, would you put them in the other room? We got 5 rooms now. I figured, what the hell, we both like each other. All you have to do is explain something. You identify with that? Just explain it intelligently. Until next Wednesday when he came along. I walk in there and there's a clothes all over the place. Now, I never explain anything twice. A person's lucky I explain it once. My reaction is, scream. And I swear. And I take these clothes and I throw them all over the place. And I rationalize by saying, if she didn't understand me the last time, she'll understand me this time. You must remember, a person who cannot accept another person is a person who has to be intellectually rationalize the problem and saying, hey kid, I am wrong and you're right, I am right and you're wrong. I am right and you're wrong and that's the way it is. And you get more divorces than me. So I figured, well, now that I blew my top, next Wednesday, you don't see those clothes there. You kidding? You know, it got so bad on Wednesday, I see clothes before I get in there. Now, I travel with Father Fred, but I'm sober longer than me, so no, I don't ask for your advice. You know, when you're sober longer than anybody else, you don't ask for advice. But I do mention it. And he gave me one of the most stupid answers. I said to myself, through a priest, he's very stupid. You know what he says? Why don't you help her? Me? Or painting the house 14 hours and come home and help somebody to put a clothes away? You gotta be kidding. You see, what I really believe is that you can earn love. St. Francis said you cannot earn love. St. Francis said, you pray to love rather than to seek love, whether you work 14 hours whether you're rich, whether you pay for everything, whether you're tired of law, don't change to fit your own convenience. And if you have a problem in your relationship, the longer that you point your finger to your friend, the longer you're going to have a problem with relationship. Yeah. Three months later, Kathy and I got married. We had $85. I said to her, would you like to go on a honeymoon? We went on a honeymoon. We came back with $35. We moved into a 3-4-room apartment. We paid $13.50. We had absolutely nothing. Nobody showed up in our wedding. Only 6 people. We had no furniture, no bed. This lady was talking today. No blankets, nothing, just the 2 of us. And the coffee table that people who run the faith house, the man used to make furniture, so we got a coffee table. Kathy says to me, where are we going to sleep? I said, we'll sleep on the floor. What the hell, I've been around long enough to know that you can have fun on the floor. I said that one time in a meeting, and this lady came to me after the meeting, and she said, young man, I don't know how much fun you can have on the floor, she said, but I know you can have a lot of fun in the Oriental rug. I said, thank God you identify. Laying on the floor, I said to Kathy, you know, I'm the only one left, and I would like to have a boy. And if you'll give me a boy, I'll buy you a diamond. So, a little sticky laying on the floor, promising a diamond. But the beautiful thing was, Kathy was sick enough, so she believed me. Hospital, waiting for a boy. And I walk into a bank first time in my life. I wanted $200. And you know what they told me? I needed collateral. I didn't know what the hell it was. You know, people in AA talk about everything but collateral. Did you ever speak in AA talk about collateral? I talk about collateral. I went 3 banks and then needed collateral. So I went to see Paul and I said, Paul, what's collateral? He said, don't worry about it, John, you don't have any. I said, what can I do? He said, you can pray. I said, Christ, Paul, they don't need God, they need collateral, you know. But I went to Hudson, 7 miles, and I met the gentleman. Told him about Kathy and I. He says, we don't mend money with sad stories. But you know, after a while he says, well, how much do you want anyway? And you know, he sounded so good, I said, $400. He gave me $400, and I walked in the jeweler's store, and I said to Alan, jeweler, became a good friend years later, best the diamond I want. Show me the best diamond. He did. I said, show me the cheapest one. So I bought one for $150, and I brought it to Kathy in the hospital. She calls me up crying, and she said, honey, it's a girl. I said, you got to be kidding. Next Christmas came along. She was in there again. Called me up. She's still crying. Said, honey, it's a girl. Next Christmas came along, and she was in there again. Called me up, still crying. This time, it's twin boys. So if you work hard enough, God will give you what you want. So 2 Christmases later, Rita came along. 2 years later, Bill. Now I got 2 girls married, 2 in college. One of my twins are in Montreal, talks 4 languages, studies languages, McGill University. Nothing but the best. I got a daughter who is in St. Thomas University. One of my twins works for me the past couple of years. I'm in remodeling business. Got a license too. And we got a 16-year-old son at home. And that's my story. And in closing, I just want to repeat. If you ask me what is the most important thing that AA have taught you, I will tell you to be able to enjoy my weekend years. That was what's missing in my life. and to be able to be grateful and proud that I could stand up and fear my life. So much of it has to do for so many people who once took time, gave me that help when I didn't even know. I was too sick to know that I needed help. To be able to enjoy your King Sai bread and to be grateful for your free dinner. And so many thanks, you know, when you kneel down tonight, the list can be so long, because you can remember so many places and so many things and so many people. So many things you can thank God for such a good life. Thank God for AA and for our co-founder. He too started off with no scared and lost. But he turned to God, it worked, and he put it in second step, and he says, "For you who are new, there is a hope. Come to believe that there is a power greater than yourself, and it can restore you." Thank you very much.
I'll let you know what my prayer is.
A woman who I actually met her this afternoon up in Sacramento, and I had to begin with offering an amends to her. The program states that she is from Groveland, and she asked her if she would mind moving to Groveland so that the program wouldn't be wrong. But she is from Sacramento, totally my error on that part. We listened to some speaker tapes, and we were all very excited about offering this service position to her, and very excited that she accepted the position, and then we gave her directions to get here and got her lost. So not only am I grateful that she was willing to accept our offer to come and speak with us, but I'm very happy she was just able to find the hotel. So I turn it now over to Judy C. from Sacramento. Thank you.
Actually, I'm from Roseville. Woo! Well, hi everybody. I'm Judy, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I'd like to start off by thanking the organizers of this event. It is a huge deal to organize any event. And I know how much time and effort and patience and prayer and love and compassion it has required for you all to do this. So thank you, organizers, and thank you for inviting me here. It's a privilege to be here. Well, I went to an Al-Anon meeting the other night, and for the first time I heard about the four M's of Al-Anon. And this was new for me. I had never heard this before. These are the four M's of Al-Anon. Managing. Some of you might find these familiar. Manipulating. Mothering. And martyrdom. Now, I have to be truthful from the very start in my share. So the first thing I want to say is that I am, and my partner will attest to this, an Al-Anon princess. So, I am very long on managing and manipulating, and kind of short on mothering and martyrdom. And the reason why I really perked up my ears about those four M's is they relate to really what I want to share with you tonight about my experience. Because manipulating and managing are the opposite of letting go absolutely, which is a wonderful phrase from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says in How It Works, and so, you know, I just sort of flew by, didn't pay much attention, but lately, every time someone reads How It Works, I hear this sentence. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil. Until we let go absolutely. Now, this word is very disturbing to to an Al-Anon, this absolute word. And actually, it goes on, you know, in how it works. And it says, we asked his protection and care with complete abandon. So here are these words, let go absolutely and complete abandon. These are very difficult and dangerous words for an Al-Anon. So before I go into this a little more, let me just qualify myself a little bit and tell you a little bit about myself. So I know that Al-Anon is a family disease, and I know it's an extended family disease because in my immediate family, we didn't have any alcoholics and didn't have any recognizable Al-Anons, but I had an uncle that died of the disease, and I had an aunt who was absolutely black belt, non-recovering Al-Anon, who was married to an alcoholic who died of the disease. So although it wasn't right nearby, immediately in my family, it was very close, all around me. But of course, I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon or any of that until I was about 40, when, after about a year of coming out here on business, I lived in New Hampshire, I developed a friendship with a woman who was a recovering alcoholic. I fell in love with her. And left my marriage and my two kids in New Hampshire and drove all the way across the country to be with her. And we arrived in Sacramento on a Friday night. Or maybe it was a Thursday night. I'm not sure. But we went to North Hall that next night, Friday night. It's my first AA meeting. And I was a little stunned. But I was grateful that, you know, I was a quiet Al-Anon. So I didn't have to say anything. And I went to AA meetings with my partner for about 3 months. And then one night we went out for coffee with a good friend of hers named Dean. And Dean D. looked at me during the coffee period and he said, "So Judy, so have you started going to Al-Anon yet?" And I looked at him, I said, "Well, no. Why should I go to Al-Anon?" And he says, "Well, you live with an alcoholic." And I said, "Oh, but she's a recovering alcoholic. She's a recovered alcoholic. She doesn't drink." And he just laughed. He started laughing. And he just laughed and laughed and laughed. So I was incensed the whole way home that night. You know, Pat was driving, and I was saying, "Well, who in the world does he think he is, and why should I have to go to an Al-Anon meeting, and blah, 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 on and on and on." Full of self-righteous indignation. And we got home that night, we got in bed, turned out the lights. I lay there for a few minutes, and I burst into tears. And she said, "You know, well, what's wrong?" And I said, "I realized that I picked, you know, I left my marriage, I left my kids, I drove all the way across the country to live with someone that I picked who was an alcoholic." And that was just a huge breakthrough for me. And a little while later, a month or so later, I finally got myself to a meeting. And I hid out in some straight meetings for a while. But finally, I got myself to living sober. That was the first living sober I ever went to. And I went to a workshop where Joanne L. was talking, and I totally identified with her, and that was the beginning of my life in Al-Anon. And so this year, this coming Living Sober, which I use as my anniversary date, I'll have 14 years in the program. So I'm really grateful that I found the Al-Anon program. So back to the four M's, or the two M's as it is for me, managing and manipulating, and the opposite of letting go absolutely. Now, I actually picked this as a topic at an Al-Anon meeting recently to see how it would go over, and it was amazing what came up. Okay, so here's what I heard for letting go absolutely. Letting go periodically. Letting go tentatively. Letting go reluctantly, letting go desperately, letting go every now and then, letting go partially, and almost never letting go. So this was a source of great, you know, I really wanted to contemplate this. Okay, so letting go absolutely. What does this mean to me? Well, it's a scary concept because first I had to think about, before I could even approach this word absolutely, I had to think about what it was I was really letting go of. And this is very confusing for an Al-Anon, for this Al-Anon, because when I came to the program, I wasn't even sure who I was bringing in the room. I mean, I wasn't even sure that I was, that there was anything of me to hold on to. And so after a lot of thinking about it, I decided that the most important thing, oh, I know, I forgot to say something. Wisdom is often, someone told me this once, wisdom is often knowing what to hold on to and what to let go of. And in Al-Anon, I'd let go of so much. I'd let go of myself. I'd let go of my wants. I'd let go of my desires. So the idea of letting go, what to let go, was pretty confusing to me. Finally, after a lot of thought, I got clear that the thing that I have to hold on to is me. And for me, that's, you know, the idea that I'm real, that I exist, that I'm actually substantive, not what somebody else thinks of me, that I really exist, that I'm real, that I'm good, that I have a truth. You know, it may not be your truth, but it's my truth. I have a truth. And towards other people. And that's what I really need to hold on to, is this awareness of me as real, as good, as having my own truth, as being loving and compassionate. And so if that's what I want to hold on to, then what is it that I let go of? And I know everyone in this room can answer this question. You know, it's my expectations. In particular, it's my way. It's my pride. The concepts that I have of doing things the right way. You know, I just really am the kind of a person who knows that there is a right way to load a dishwasher. And there is a right way to make a bed. And there are many times when I have reloaded the dishwasher and remade the bed. So I have a lot of concepts. And the other thing that I know I need to let go of is my fear. You know, when I came into the program, I was so frightened of everything. I remember after my third meeting, I went up to a woman who I felt had some experience in Al-Anon just by listening in the meeting, and the tears were rolling down my face, and all I could get out of my mouth was, "I'm so afraid." And it was so sweet. She just simply was not overwhelmed by me, you know. She just sort of patted me on the back and gave me a hug and said, "Keep coming back." You know, it was just the best thing anybody could have said to me. But after 14 years in the program, I've kind of boiled down all the fears that I have into sort of one thing. What I'm really afraid of is not getting what I need. And mostly that's love and acceptance, you know, unconditional love and self-acceptance, accepting myself. That's what I need. And whenever I'm afraid, I think it's really, when you get right down to it, it's because I'm not going to get what I need. And therefore, I have to manipulate and manage so that I can be sure that I will get it. So all of this is very heady and blah, blah. Let me tell you a story about how it works for me. And this is a very recent story. The other night, my partner and I had some visitors at our house, and they picked out a movie to watch on the VCR. just the perfect movie for me. I love these kinds of movies. But Pat, my partner, she just hates them. You know, she likes... I read Jane Austen, she reads John Grisham, you know. So, and Tom Clancy, and I don't know who else. Anyway, so as soon as that movie was picked, I knew it was, you know, I knew there was no way she was going to stay up. And sure enough, after about 30 minutes of being polite, she got up and she said, "Good night, everybody," and she went to bed. So I stayed and watched the movie. Okay. So I came upstairs at the end of the movie, and I walked into the bedroom. And, you know, it was dark in the bedroom. And I have trouble, I don't know about you, but I have trouble taking my jewelry off in the dark, you know? So I just turned on the light. Well, I thought it was like World War II, you know? It was like just grumpiness rising up out of the bed. And, of course... You know, I immediately had 1,000 reasons why it was perfectly fine for me to turn the light on and wake her up. You know, one of which was, of course, that I could not take my jewelry off in the dark. I mean, give me a break. So then I sat down on the bed, kind of rough, and took off my shoes. And, of course, that elicited more grump rising up out of the bed. But finally, I just... You know, I turned off the light, I got undressed, I got in bed. So you can imagine there's a lot of silence now, right? A lot of silence in the bed. Me, you know, Judy, you are so... And I thought a minute and I said, you know, you are really right. I am rude and selfish. And then there was this more silence. And then I was struggling. I was at that perfect Al-Anon moment, which I know many of you know, which is, you know, should I grovel? Should I seek revenge? And, of course, if we can figure out, which we're really smart, if we can figure out about how to do both at the same time, that is the best. Because then you're groveling, but there's this little knife somehow that you're just like sliding in the midst of the grovel. Like, I couldn't just take it, you know? I didn't want to grovel, but I just couldn't do nothing. So after a few moments, I took a deep breath and I said, well... You're demanding and a pain in the butt to live with. And it's a tribute to our relationship that, and our maturity and our working the program, that that's where it ended. You know, that's where it stopped. And there was silence, and I rolled over and went to sleep, and she went to sleep, I guess, I hope, I don't know. I wasn't paying attention. So the next morning, the sun rose up, and I rolled over, and I made an amend. And I said, I'm sorry that I disturbed you, and I turned the light on, and the next time this happens, I will get undressed in the other room. Now, what does this story, you know, tell me about me? It tells me that in 14 years of working the program, there are some things that I've been able to let go of, and there are some things that I am still holding on to. So what am I holding on to, and what am I letting go of, you know? Well, what I have let go of is this groveling behavior, which used to drive me nuts. I mean, I was so full of inner agitation when she got mad at me, because I had no detachment. And I used to like smile at her and try to make up, you know, for it. And it feels like such a freedom, such a release to not have to grovel anymore. I can like just wait for things to settle down and improve, on their own even, you know, before I rush after. That's great. And the revenge that I took was much milder. than my previous experiences with revenge. I mean, it was really an improvement. And I didn't say it actually very angrily. I just said it in a matter-of-fact way. You know, and it's kind of like for me, at that moment, it was speaking my truth. That was my truth at that moment. And holding on to my expectations, my way of doing things, and ultimately, I'm holding on to this little bit of fear. And I didn't really even get this until I contemplated, until I thought about this event at least two or three times. And I suddenly realized why I turned the light on. I turned the light on because I was still angry at her that she wasn't watching the movie that I wanted to watch. Now, this is like really dumb. I mean, I know that she doesn't like those movies. And actually, when she got up and left the room, I felt totally accepting of the fact that she left the room. But way deep inside of me, there's this little fear that if she doesn't like what I like, I must be wrong. And I resent having that feeling that I must be wrong. And so I just had to get back at her just a little bit for not liking the movie that I like. Now, isn't that amazing? After 14 years in the program, after letting go of so much, that we can still have these little subtle junk in there that causes us to manipulate the people that we really love. And that's why it's so important to keep coming back, because it doesn't like go away. It just gets subtler and subtler and subtler is what happens. So we have to keep working on it. I have to let go of it, absolutely. I'm at that point that I can change anybody or anything. I don't even think I can change myself anymore. What I can do is change my attitude or my awareness. So to go back to what I said earlier, you know, if I am, I have to, let me think about how I want to say this. I have to hold on to the awareness of who I am as a good person. And what I've discovered is that the more I let go of that, my awareness of me being a good person, the more I let go of that, the more I have to hold on to this other junk, this pride, this defensiveness, these concepts, this whatever. And the more I let go of that, the more I hold on to who I am. So, lest you think that I am well and wonderful, let me assure you that I am not. This past year has been a really difficult time for me. And I want to take a minute and share a little bit about it, and be real. In surgery. And we all know what happened in September. On October 18th, my mother died. She was 87 years old, and I was her primary caregiver. And after her death, I spent the next two or three months being sick most of the time. That was apparently how I was dealing with my grief. I just had a series of like really bad colds and viruses, one after the other. And finally, I started to feel better. And our dog got this really virulent form of cancer. And he's a puppy. He was 2.5 years old. And we had to put him down after about 3 weeks. So it's been a real dark time for me. A lot of dark things have been happening to me. And I actually know from talking to a lot of friends that it's been a dark time for many of us just because of what happened in September. And none of those things could I control. None of them. I had to let go absolutely of, you know, how Pat was caregiving her dad, all of her family, all around that. I had to let go of my mother, my Doug. I had to let go of these terrible events that have happened to us. And I can't say that I haven't felt sad, and I haven't felt heavy. There are some mornings, you know, I remember one of the things I identified with Joanne L. was, she talked about what she was like in the morning. She said there are some Al-Anons who wake up in the morning and they say, "Good morning! How are we this morning? Wake up, wake up! The sun is shining! It's a beautiful day!" You know, and it's just, as soon as she did that, I thought, God, that is me. And of dealing with life is denial. Right? And I'm here to tell you that I do not wake up like that anymore. I do not. It's one of the blessings of the program that I am not in denial, and I'm sure my partner thinks it's a great blessing too. So I have actually had some mornings this past 7 or 8 months when I have woken up and I have not felt like getting out of bed. And it literally felt like a heaviness. It's as though I wake up and the air feels heavy on me, and it's saying to me, just don't get up, you know. I see some heads nodding out there, so I know there are people out here who feel this way. So it's not that I haven't felt that way, but there have been some real changes in my life. And the first one is this letting go of denial. The first one is this looking at life the way it is, not the way I expect it to be, the way I wish it were. You know, life is pretty awesome. That means for me, it is full of awe, you know, and September 11th was a time of tremendous, like, you know, awe, just overwhelming awe. Is how I felt it. But I am not being in denial about that or about the world situation. The second thing that's really important to me that's a change is that I no longer have the need to fix it. I grew up in a family where somebody, I don't know who it was, gave me the notion that I had the obligation and the power to fix what wasn't working. And it didn't matter whether it was what wasn't working in my house or my school or my community or my world, you know. I was the duly designated fixer. And today, you know, I can look at some pretty awesome things that are happening out there, some pretty horrible things, and I can say today, you know, I do not have to fix this. This is happening. It's real. But I do not have to fix it. Now, that may not sound like much, but for me, that's a huge deal. It's a huge shift for me. And it goes back to letting what I can let go of. Absolutely. And, of course, you all know this. It's not like you let it go once, right? I mean, letting go absolutely is letting go every second that we take a breath in and we put a breath out. Every second. And that sometimes feels a little onerous, you know, like hard work. But on the other hand, every second we get a fresh start, right? That's another way to look at it. If we didn't let go 5 minutes ago, well, we have an opportunity right now to let go. So, a fresh start, letting go, absolutely. Well, I haven't taken up all the time, but I'm done. So I'm going to end. I'm going to end by saying that what I've discovered, I can hold on to.